Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, especially the joy you feel when you share that love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program as kind of an introduction with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. Jesus was impressed by the young men who came to question him, for they possessed wisdom beyond their years. He smiled with gentle admiration and love because he could see how wide their minds had opened to receive truth. Jesus' followers were pleased to see him so happy and relaxed. The young men, for their part, felt very much at ease because they could feel Christ's love flowing over them as they asked him one question after another. Not foolish questions, but meaningful questions which Jesus knew they had thought a lot about before asking them. One of the young men cleared his throat and said, "Master, I've asked you many questions, and you have proven yourself to be a man of great knowledge. I have another question to which I haven't given much thought. It suddenly entered my mind, and I can't seem to get rid of it." Jesus smiled and said, "Then ask it, and you may be enlightened." The young man asked, "Master, is it right for man to use his mind to ask questions?" Jesus smiled, and it turned into a laugh, which was rare for him, and he said, "What do you think you have been doing during the many hours you have spent with me?" They all began to laugh now, not in a mocking way, but with love in their hearts and voices. Jesus said, "I tell you this, if man does not question, if he does not seek to know what is on the top of the mountain, if he does not want to know my Father, then he should not use his mind. And if he does not want to know my Father's love, he should stop asking questions and not seek it. I say to the man who does nothing but listen to others, who never questions, who never wonders, you are a foolish child. You have locked the door to life. If a man is to grow, he must view the world with wonder and be willing to learn about life from even the lowliest of God's creatures." And then Jesus bent down and picked up a small bug that was crawling on the ground. It became still in Jesus' hand, and he said, "Look, he knows he is no longer on the ground, but on a human hand. And he does not know if he will be crushed or placed gently on the ground again. Man can learn much from even so simple a lesson as this." Then Jesus gently placed the bug upon the earth and said, "I tell you this, listen to what people have to say and do not be quick to condemn. Ask many questions, and then call upon the Heavenly Father to guide you so that you make the right decisions, so that you will know whether you should believe what has been told you or whether you should remove it from your mind." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening describes himself as not being anti-technology, but being concerned about it, and particularly the directions it appears to be heading. it's his sincere desire that you will find this book useful in judging what measure of harm or profit you stand to gain by employing modern automatic machine technologies. He writes in his latest book titled Modern Technology and the Human Future, subtitled A Christian Appraisal. Christianly speaking, the observation that automatic machine development is deviating away from ordinary embodied human existence needs to be followed by the proclamation of the embodied and deeply humanizing implications of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Such a proclamation is the gist of this chapter. There are, however, several features. For not only has contemporary secular culture fallen asleep to the dangers of technology, technological dehumanization, but many of our churches also appear to have forgotten how central ordinary embodied human existence is to Christian faith. That modern secular culture has not offered much in the way of resistance to the dehumanizing thrust of automatic machine development is unfortunate, though perhaps understandable. Given the material fruits of technological development hitherto, given its alluring promises of more, better, faster, and easier, given the powerful monetary interests that attach to creative destructive innovation, and given that the modern mind remains, romantic protests notwithstanding, by and large mechanical in its outlook, it is not terribly surprising that modern secular thought has been largely acquiescent in the face of recent technological developments. While this could change, it is not clear that modern secular thought possesses the intellectual wherewithal to amount much of a protest. Protests thus far have been raised in the name of rights, either to privacy or on behalf of groups believed to be deserving of a larger share of technology's material benefits. Still, they have not as a rule taken issue with the drift of automated machinery away from ordinary embodied human existence. While authors like Nicholas Carr have sought to sound the alarm over this drift, the postmodern intellectual environment has made it almost impossible to protest this development in the name of truth. Yet the momentum and inertia of modern technological development are not likely to be alterable in the name of anything less. It is genuinely tragic, then, that our churches have not offered more considered resistance to modern automatic machine development. For the extraordinarily high value of ordinary embodied human being is a core Christian truth. He says just a couple sentences later, the church has long recognized that if the eternal Word of God, quote, became flesh and made his dwelling among us, close quote, as the Apostle John declares, this confers staggering value upon ordinary fleshly existence. Craig Gay is a professor of interdisciplinary studies at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada. He is the author of several books, including Dialogue, Catalog, and Monologue, Personal, Impersonal, and Depersonalizing Ways to Use Words. Cash Values, The Value of Money and the Nature of Worth. The Way of the Modern World, or Why It's Tempting to Live as If God Doesn't Exist. And With Liberty for Justice for Whom? The Recent Evangelical Debate Over Capitalism. Professor Craig Gay, welcome to Amplify.
Thank you very much.
I loved your book. Just gives a deeper understanding into a lot of popular articles that are coming out about the use of media today and how it might affect us, but you bring it into the Christian context is where I want to get the final words of my introduction got there. But especially during the last hour of the program, I'd like to be able to spend our time on the last two or three chapters of the book. But the first part is so very interesting. I would think, first of all, that your class might be like the discussion that I had in my opening story with young people, their minds open to hear what it is that you have to teach them about as they face the world in front of them. Why should we be grateful for the times in which we live, being beneficiaries, as you say, of the astonishing increase in human productivity made possible by modern technology? Why should we be grateful for living now?
Well, I just think it's made our lives rich in many ways. I mean, not least of which is in terms of health.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't, but I think most of us wouldn't be here were it not for the benefits of modern medical technologies of a variety of kinds. But, I mean, just the fact that we're able to talk to each other tonight is made possible by some pretty extraordinary advanced technology.
Yes.
I mean, there's no reason not. I think we ought to be grateful for all of these things. They're good in many, many ways.
What do you mean by the term technology? Let's start there as we begin our discussion.
Well, I mean, I'm using the term broadly. And broadly speaking, it just means the development of practical tools and processes for the sake of improving the quality of our lives. Going back, we can talk about human development. You think of the technologies that make cooking possible.
Yes.
Which leads to homemaking and sociability. And think of clothing. Think of transportation, agriculture, communications. I mean, you know, the list is long. I do spend a fair amount of time talking about some specific technologies in the book, you know, more recent things. But in general, I'm trying not to get narrowed down to a mm-hmm. A super specific definition.
Okay. Why does the development of technology come naturally to us human beings?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, as far back as we look, it's there. It's just a part of human being in the world. The people reflecting on it talk about technology as that which lifts us out of the immediacy of natural existence and enables us to get a kind of necessary distance from nature.
Mm-hmm.
Which enables us to do a whole bunch of things. I mean, it enables us to think about nature, to rearrange it, to cultivate it, to think about ourselves. And yet, technology at its best leaves us still vitally connected to our world. And our technologies, I think, should and often have enabled us to become more human, more engaged with each other, more engaged with the natural world, more present in it. So all of that's good, and it just seems to be a part of what it means to be human. The concern, though, and this is the concern I'm trying to voice in the book, is that recent technological development, rather than enabling us to become more of ourselves, seems instead to be diminishing us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out, you know, why is it? What accounts for this diminishment? And why is it that we're not more concerned about it? And then that's the stage for the Christian understanding of how, you know, how, another way of thinking about it.
You point out that automatic machine technology is not always beneficial, as you just noted, and you want us to think about it from the standpoint of the impact that is that it's having on us, us being an embodied human being. And as you just kind of explained, our technologies disclose and shape our self-understanding, our way of being in the world. And in that first chapter, you use many examples to show how some scientists, some people were observing something inhuman and ultimately dehumanizing about modern machine technology that man, and this was not hard to believe and yet hard to believe, that man is becoming a slave to the machine. Tell us a little bit about that. You write a lot about that in the book.
Well, I mean, automatic machine technology, it's designed to be automatic. That's the whole point of it.
Yes.
And what that means and has meant, I mean, this isn't new. This goes all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century. Probably earlier. It just means eliminating eliminating the human, basically, from yes. machine processes, because humans are unreliable. They get tired and they make mistakes and they have, you know, their judgment is not entirely good sometimes. And so, you know, if you can get these darn people out of the systems, you can make them much more efficient and much more predictable. And of course, that was the genius of the factory system that, that was a term that was coined by Karl Marx in the beginning of the 19th century. And he observed that the brilliance of the modern production systems is that it's found a way of eliminating the unreliably human from the machine process. And as a result, these machine processes have become much more efficient. And it's true. I mean, they work. They work better for being automatic. And that push has continued. That was 150 years ago, even more. And it continues. And this is what we're seeing. I mean, modern production facilities are very rapidly replacing human beings with automatic machinery. It's cheaper and it's more reliable.
Yeah, some people believe, you're right, that it's a necessary and inevitable aspect of human evolution. That, as you alluded to, there's a new way of being, a way of being more than merely human. You write, modern digital technology holds out the promise, conceivably realizable in the very new future, of an entirely new way of being more than merely human, merely human. Indeed, you write, digital technology holds out the promise of a transhuman existence, free from the physical limitations of time and space, even free ultimately from death. And so we are surprised, you write, to discover, after the things that used to burden us have been conveniently removed, that our lives have become disengaged, distracted, and lonely, and there's a sense in which even the human soul can be affected. So we're going to take this break and then come back and discuss even more. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Professor Craig Gay. We're talking about his latest book, Modern Technology and the Human Future, and the most important part, perhaps, is a Christian appraisal. He believes that what we want to get to is that point eventually. What is Christianity's place in all of this. He believes that human consciousness has experienced a kind of leap of being, that our potential as human beings has been decisively shaped by technologies, that modern devices are designed and developed to do much of what they do without need of any skilled human input. That's what he closed off during the first part of our program. And he writes, prudence requires us to at least ask whether our technologies are now enabling us to become more of ourselves, whether they are facilitating deeper and more meaningful human relationships, whether they are enabling us to be more dynamically engaged with the world. One suspects that they are not. Indeed, it appears that some of our technologies are actually, albeit inadvertently, disengaging us from each other, from the natural world, from ourselves. Professor, tell us a little bit about why and how we've allowed modern technology to run roughshod over human beings.
Well, I think, I mean, just to back up just a tad.
Sure.
You know, this issue, everyone's worried about this. I mean, this is, you know, what's going on with technology and technological development. And I think people are beginning to become more and more concerned about the apparent tendency of technological development away from ordinary human being. But I think in some ways the more serious problem is that these developments flow out of our own understanding of what the world is and of who we are within the world. And I'm concerned to sort of tease this out, because if we're encouraged in lots of different ways to understand the world on the analogy of machinery, I mean, that's kind of what science encourages us to do and has done for, you know, since the 17th century. And if then we look at the world as a kind of elaborate, intricate machine, and if we even see ourselves as part of the machinery and understand our bodies as machine systems, then all of a sudden the difference between the world and ourselves and technology kind of disappears. And any further advance in technology seems justified just on the basis of the fact that, well, isn't developing better machinery always a good thing? And that, I think, is the kind of background assumption that I'm wanting to look at, wanting to figure out where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And then wanting to measure that up against Christian understanding of creation and Christian understanding of the human vocation within creation. Because I think this machine analogy really breaks down at that point. It's not helping us. And it's actually preventing us from really seeing what's happening around us.
And so that brings us again to the question, why and how have we allowed that technology to run roughshod over human beings?
Well, I mean, there are two reasons chiefly. And the one just talked about, which is this, you know, because we imagine the world as basically a machine.
Ah, okay.
But the other main reason is that it's been productive, and it's generated, it's tied into our whole economic system. And so basically doing things and inventing systems to produce stuff is profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And so a good deal of economic growth depends upon productivity that is made possible by machine systems, and we all depend on it. So, you know, the combination of economic factors with this sort of imagination problem that we have means that we've kind of become blind to what technology is actually doing to the world, but also what it's doing to us. That's my concern.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about the economic factors you refer to, because there are powerful economic forces involved here, aren't there?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, productivity means basically producing more stuff with less input. And the easiest way to increase productivity today is to automate production systems. And this is hugely profitable. And it's making at least some people fantastically wealthy. But the problem is that how far can we push this? I mean, sooner or later, there aren't going to be, there won't be anything left for any of us to do. And that, I think, possibility is just starting now to dawn on more and more people. This is not a distant future. This is potentially, just around the corner. It's one of those things that it's kind of driven along automatically by cost-benefit calculations and efficiency and other concerns. And like I said, I mean, we all benefit from it in the sense that we depend upon economic growth. And the best sort of book I read about this recently was a book a few years back where the fellow was talking about what he called a progress trap, which is where a civilization is moving in a particular direction with a sort of civilizational system. And even when it becomes apparent that the civilization is heading for disaster, it has proven difficult and impossible for many civilizations to change, because everyone depends upon the way the system works as it is. And that's kind of what I'm a little concerned about with this, the technology and also the economics of automation and automated systems.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Professor Craig Gay about his book, Modern Technology and the Human Future. And you talked about the progress trap. Tell us a little bit about the concept of the homeless mind, hopeless mind.
Well, I don't use that word because there's always hope.
Yes.
Homeless, yeah, that was it's the title of a book that was written by my doctoral supervisor, Peter Berger. Excellent book. He's talking about the impact of modernization on consciousness. But again, it stems out of the, in part at least, out of this mechanical world picture that if the world is a basically just a machine system, gosh, that leaves us kind of lonely inside it. I mean, who are we then? Where is there place for us?
The modern workplace, you write, tends to discourage big picture thinking about the meaning and significance of the work progress.
Well, yeah, just because the modern workplace is specialized, and specialists tend to know a lot about very little, and it just in the nature of that specialization that it sort of discourages big picture thinking. And big picture thinking is what basically, another word for that is wisdom. Mm-hmm. And the modern, educational systems don't really encourage the development of wisdom. That's not what they're designed to do. They're designed to enable us to be employable within very specialized work systems.
Between pages 34 and 58, if you'd saw my book, it would almost look as if though I highlighted almost everything. There's just so much here. One, it was determined that human pilots, having become so used to computer control, had basically forgotten how to fly their aircraft. A similar diminishment of proficiency appears to extend to anyone who uses any kind of automated device for any purpose. That's a really strong thought. I mean, frightening thought in many ways. That indeed, as we said in the first part, that we become a slave to technology. The master-slave relation becomes nearly as dehumanizing for the master as for the slave, because we become slaves to mechanical masters. And you indicated that may not be too far off.
Well, I mean, you don't want to exaggerate this. I think, because, like we said at the beginning, we need to be grateful for a lot of this. But I think it's true that, I think of this every time I have to do any kind of calculation. What do we do now? You pull out your phone, or you pull out usually your phone, and you pull up the calculator function, and you enter the numbers in, and it produces a result. But, and every now and then you find yourself without a phone, and it's like, oh no, how do I do that again? How do I multiply? How do I subtract? How do I do long division? And these are things that we used to know how to do, and we used to be pretty good at them. But now, because of our phones and because we have these devices at our fingertips, we've gotten out of the habit of doing them, and so we've forgotten. Well, that's sort of basic. And the thing is that our engagement with reality wants us to be, I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but we thrive at the more vibrantly we are related and engaged with the real world. That's what God made us to do and to be. And to allow these devices and these machine systems and so forth to get in the way of that diminishes us. It makes our lives easier, or it seems to. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it also makes our lives empty. And I think we all have experience of this. I'm just trying to get my readers to sort of realize, to understand how this process works, and to begin to resist it. For the sake of making life vibrant again. Yes. and rich and engaged.
And I'd say you have succeeded at least with one reader, and that's me.
Oh, good.
Certainly with me, and if it's me, there's certainly many others. Also, highlighting the book and marking it all up allows me to go back again. Having read through it once in order to prepare for this program, I really intend to go back and read it even more fully and think about it a little more as I read it than rather just reading it through. A lot of examples there. You write about the American composer and conductor John Philip Sousa predicted in 1906 that the technology of musical recording would inevitably lead to the demise of music. And you write, while Sousa was clearly mistaken about music per se, recorded music does tend to obscure the human effort that has gone into making it. The paradox of musical recording is that while it is able to capture moments of musical sound, it fails to preserve the human spirit with which the music was produced. And I say that because I just came back from this afternoon, Pittsburgh Symphony, this glorious concert by Tchaikovsky, actually almost moved to tears from it. And so I understand fully what you're saying there, and so much more in the book. It's really, it has really in many ways opened my mind in ways of deepening my appreciation of what's happening all around me and is happening to me without my always being aware of it. And I think that's very, very, very valuable. There's just so many examples. I find myself overwhelmed by your book that I could go on and on. Sometimes a guest fails to show up for one reason or another, or has had a problem, and I have to, at the last minute, fill in. And I have enough in my mind that I can get out there and talk about things that I'm just talking today in my homily, my sermon, for example. But I could sit down with this book and easily go through this program. Well, you know, to explain what you were writing about, I wouldn't understand it, of course, like you do. But people would be fascinated, and that's why it's a book that is to a little more depth than maybe perhaps some people normally read. But it's not of the depth that they would not understand. And so you write, it's not unusual for people to feel more comfortable in an unreal place than a real one, because they feel in simulation they show their better and perhaps truer self. And then the concept, a lot of the things are, from what you've read, techno brain burnout can eventually lead to permanent changes in the underlying structure of the brain. And so we're talking about the fact that some people actually believe that our brain is being changed. So there's this curious thing happening as we're learning more about the brain. We're learning that, as a matter of fact, there are not only these positive qualities that we're learning about, but we need to be careful also about the destructive influences, don't we? And again, like you say, let's not overstate this. I don't want to do that, but it's just when you discover something new, it may seem like you're overstating. I'm not you. I'm talking about me.
Yeah. No, well, thank you. I appreciate your comments. Yeah, I mean, there's more and more research coming out about the impact of especially screen technologies on people in general, but on young people in particular, and especially, you know, kids, small kids. And the research is disturbing. I mean, this is not good for kids, especially. Just the constant stimulation with, you know, bright colors, bright images, rapidly moving noise, you know, not to mention often shocking images. But this has an impact. It has a lasting impact on the way kids develop. And a lot of the things I think we would want to encourage our children to develop are actually impeded by this the time they're spending on screens. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take our next break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Professor Craig A. about his book, Modern Technology and the Human Future. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where our guest is Professor Craig Gay. He has written a book titled Modern Technology and the Human Future, a Christian Appraisal. He's a professor of interdisciplinary studies at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada. Professor, I thank you for coming on. It must be difficult for someone like you who has such discipline and specificity in your thought process to come onto a talk show that in even 2 40-minute segments is trying to cover even just a part of the book so as to present it in a way that more people will want to read what it is you have to say. So, again, thank you for being with us this evening.
Well, thank you. I'm grateful for the chance.
Good. Tell us a little bit about chapter 2 and 3. I have all kinds of questions, but I really want to be able to jump to the end of the book, which is really where you were leading in your whole book anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, the book breaks out into these 5 chapters, but 2 and 3 have to do with understanding the economic implications of, or, you know, the economic factors that influence the development of modern technology. And then chapter 3 is an exploration of this, this what I call a mechanical world picture that we tend to approach the world and our lives in it with. And we've said something about both of those things already. And then all of those chapters then set up chapter 4 with a sort of re-exploration of a couple of sort of core Christian doctrines that I think have a lot to say about, at least remembering them helps us to... Or it gives us a way of evaluating technological development. So in chapter 4, then I go into talking about a theology of creation, and then the our Christian understanding of incarnation, resurrection, and you know just mm-hmm. what these doctrines have to say in respect to modern technology and our use of it.
All right, let's begin there. In fact, it was from chapter 4 that I selected the opening quote from your book at the beginning of the program so that people would know that that's where we were really going. You have this quote from St. Augustine, "We should rejoice and be in wonder that our Lord Jesus Christ was made man rather than that he, as God, performed divine deeds among men. Our salvation, after all, depends more upon what he was made on our behalf than on what he did among us." Say a little bit about that quote for us.
Isn't that an amazing quote?
Yes, it is. It certainly is.
And I think it's striking to us because it's like we probably haven't thought about it. It's like, oh, yeah. I mean, the fact that God becomes one of us, the Word becomes flesh. This is incredible. It's astonishing. I mean, and it's an astonishing endorsement of human being, ordinary human being in the world. It wasn't just something that God did and then went back to being God. God in Christ remains a human person, an embodied human being, and will always be an embodied human being. And it's because of that that we will be enabled to become most fully ourselves as embodied human beings as well. I mean, this is basic Christian teaching. And, in the context of the book, what it means is that if we see our technologies and our technological systems trending away from ordinary embodied human being, you know, all the alarms should be going off. It's like, wait a minute, that can't be good because that means that our technology is at odds with God's revealed purposes for us.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's what I'm trying to help Christians to remember and to begin to think again about the implications of these sort of basic Christian doctrines for thinking about technology.
Right, the disembodiment, might indeed be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned in the last hour about transhumanism, and there are, there's a lot of excitement about this in certain circles, that and the suggestion that, you know, this is just the next stage in human evolution, that we're going to evolve out of our bodies and into machinery, basically. I understand this. It's been sort of the stuff of science fiction for, you know, some time now. And with advanced computer technology and so forth, it looks like, hey, maybe this is really possible. But from a Christian point of view, we just have to stand up and say, no, first of all, it's not good news for real human beings, because whatever kind of being the artificial machine systems have, it's not human being. But second of all, this is where we have to, you know, come in with the gospel of Christ, that knows, yes, that God has redeemed us in Christ for fully embodied human personhood.
And part of the challenge for us is in the remembering part, is you note that the silence of the church may be related to the fact that evangelical Christians, of course others, have always been early adopters of modern technologies and have used them to great benefit. So there is this fascination with technological possibilities, and you point out that our churches have forgotten, as you just noted, the centrality of embodied human existence within the gospel of Jesus Christ, that we have fallen out of the habit of reflecting upon and living out of the implication of core Christian convictions, that Christians are not alone, and that we have a form of amnesia fostered by modernization, that we have forgotten basic Christian theology, that we live in a world we did not make, and it is not entirely up to us to decide who we will be in this world that we did not make. And so we have to ask then, what is the human task or vocation that we have within this world, that we need to think clearly about modern technological development so that we might become more and not less of ourselves? And so the first part of your book is about that, isn't it? We need to think about modern technological development so that we become more and not less of ourselves.
Well, yeah, because it certainly can do that for us. I mean, there are lots of examples of that. This problem of, you know, forgetfulness is pretty common. Certainly common in my in the traditions that I know about. And it's also true that Christians have made good use of modern technologies. I mean, you know, we're on the radio right now, right?
Yes.
You don't want to say that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But when it gets to the point where Christians of all people aren't standing up and saying, look, what we need to do is make and use our technologies to enhance ordinary human being, not to escape it, but to make it better. You know, more engaged, more vivid, more full of life. I think there are lots of examples of technologies that do that for us.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of the things that we're surrounded by now don't appear to be doing that for us. And I just feel like, look, we need to protest. But
yes,
we have to have, you know, some sense of some basis for making the protest, and that's where this recovery of theology comes in.
And
I think in terms of the doctrine of creation, the first thing that you can say is that the world is not a machine.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the best analogy. That's not the best metaphor. If you want to use a metaphor for understanding the creation, think of it as a work of art. And, you know, a work of art that has been carefully and lovingly crafted by an artist, you know, the artist, with a capital A.
Yes.
And that our job as those who experience this work of art is, you know, in the first instance, to be amazed at by it, to marvel at it, to admire it. I mean,
yes.
That's the basic
mm-hmm.
word. And that, you know, one of the things you notice when you start to, well, and one of the things the doctrine of the creation suggests is that the created order has been ordered to fullness and diversity and pluriformity and multiplicity to beauty. A good friend of mine has written a book called God's Good Creation. He uses the term superabundance. That's what God delights in fruition, in creating things to flourish. And our job as those who have been created, you know, after God's image and likeness is to, well, I think two things, basically. And one is to put all of this into speech and return the speech of praise and thanks to the God who creates all of this. I think that's implied in the biblical notion of naming,
mm-hmm.
naming the creatures. But then also, our job is to steward the created nature, to take care of it, to see that things flourish, to cultivate, to allow things to be most fully themselves. It raises all kinds of questions about, you know, how do you do this and what does it mean in this instance or that? But even if people were just asking those sorts of questions, I think this would go a long way toward helping us to sort of put technology
yes.
in its place. So that's the hope of that
mm-hmm.
that discussion in the book.
You've made reference to radio as one of the important technologies. I don't know if you realize that you are now on the world's first commercial radio station.
Is that right?
Yes, KDKA. So,
no, I didn't know that.
We're part of that miracle, you know?
Well,
so,
there we go.
Yes.
Yeah.
You write in the book, The Reason for Remembering What the Christian Religion Tells Us About Just Where We Are, Who We Are, and the Kind of Work We've Been Given to Do in This World, is so that we might begin to use our energies and our considerable talents, including our remarkable capacity for scientific knowing and technological making, to enable created things, including the creatures who have been created after God's own image and likeness, to become fully themselves. And then moving to chapter 5, What on Earth Shall We Do? You begin by writing, it is often said that modern technology is not the problem, rather the problem is what we do with it. This is true as far as it goes. Technology per se, even in the distinctively modern form, is not the real problem. What we do with technology, however, is shaped by who in the world we think we are and by the kind of world we believe ourselves to be living in. Say a little bit more about what on earth shall we do?
Well, it's easy to be critical of this development. It's harder to be constructive. And so, you know, and I'm aware of that. And there's a great, great line from G.K. Chesterton. He said, you know, the critics are almost right about what is wrong, almost always right about that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're almost always wrong about what is right. And I think that's true, and I've read many a book that falls into the kind of that category. So I was trying to end the book with some positive or constructive suggestions. And I'm borrowing most of this stuff from other authors. I like and have learned a lot from Wendell Berry, for example.
Yes.
I've learned a lot from Albert Borgman. And then most recently from a fellow named Andy Crouch, who Andy, I haven't actually met, but I've begun to have conversations with him. And he's came out recently with a book called The Tech-Wise Family that is excellent and just full of really useful practical advice. But going back to Barry, I mean, Barry just encourages us to ask, well, basically to think twice before we upgrade, because, of course, that's what we're always in the business of doing with this new technology is upgrading to this or that. And he wants us to slow down and ask ourselves, look, this stuff is promising to make our lives better and easier and more convenient and this and that. But will it really? Will it really make our lives better? And unless we are able to answer that, yes, we know it will in some meaningful way, then he says, look, don't do it. I mean, why would you? You're just making someone else rich, and you're not actually making your life any better. So, and I think that's basically good advice. The other thing that, I mean, Albert Borgman says a similar thing, except it's a little nuanced in a slightly different direction. He says, look, ask yourself, in terms of your use of technology, are your technologies enabling you to develop the disciplines and the habits and the skills that really make for an enriched engagement with the real world?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they are, great. Give thanks for them and use them, you know, use them with gratitude. But if they aren't, you know, if they're not enabling us to be more vividly engaged with each other or more engaged with the world of nature, then don't use them. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Professor, let me break in there. We need to take this break, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify with Professor Craig Gay. We're talking about his book, Modern Technology and the Human Future, A Christian Appraisal. Professor, sorry for cutting you off. I would have never done that in class. I'd have really been in trouble. So I don't know if you wanted to finish your thought, if you even remember what it was at this point.
No, that was good. I was right at the end, so
okay.
Thank you.
Let's move more into this, and then I want to leave time for the final chapter, really not a chapter, but an epilogue, you call it, on Eucharistic embodiment, because I think it's also very popular, or very important, no matter how it is that you and I may look at the Eucharist in a little different way. But you write, in some, we need to see that modern machine technology's relentless compression of time, as well as its progressive obliteration of place, must render the possibility of genuinely personal action moot. Bereft of any particular place within which to move, and deprived of the time necessary for careful and prayerful deliberation, it must become impossible for human beings to act freely, responsibly, and meaningfully. A little earlier, to Jesus's question, quote, what good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul, close quote. Secular modernity, in effect, replies, what good Could it possibly be to have a quote-unquote soul if this means forfeiting the present world, which after all is all there really is? But there is more, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. No, that, I mean, that, you were stringing a couple different thoughts together there. But no, I mean, I think one of the clues about the direction that technology is heading is this, everything is speeding up all the time, right?
Yes.
And we find this difficult. I think most of us do. And I think we're often encouraged to think that the problem is, you know, is us, right? I mean, we just need to learn how to adapt more quickly and more more fluidly. But, you know, you don't have to think about it too long before you kind of realize that, well, no, wait a minute. There's got to be a limit to this adaptation. I mean, I don't know what they're saying now. I remember hearing it said recently that for, you know, a young person today, they will have to change, fundamentally change careers every couple of years.
Oh, yes.
In adulthood, right? Because, you know, the world is changing so quickly. And I think, well, first of all, I can't see how that is possible. But second of all, it's like, I don't want to live in a world like that. I mean, who would?
Mm-hmm.
So, and all of this is driven by, well, I think two things, by the, in a sense, the logic of automatic computer-generated technology, but also it's driven by the logic of money, because you know, in a money money culture, time is money, and so the more you can compress time and the more transactions you can accomplish in a certain period of time, the more money you can make. But anyway, all of that, I think, is kind of obviously a problem for real, ordinary, embodied people. And the same is true with place. For a variety of reasons, our technologies tend to flatten places out into mere space. And there are, you know, lots of examples of this. I mean, it's, you know, shopping malls begin to look the same wherever you go, and they're full of the same stores, and the stores are laid out in the same way, and they all have the same products, and you know, the parking lots all look alike, and all of that is a sort of imposition of a sort of human grid on what used to be a place, you know, a locality with its own unique sort of character. And somehow we've adopted this system that wants to impose this pattern, this rational pattern, on everything and on everyone and on every place. And I don't know. I mean, I just think that's obviously, I think we experience this as a kind of loss, that it's, This isn't what we want. It somehow doesn't speak to our souls. It's not nourishing us. And so, and you know, again, these are just clues to the fact that, you know, something is not quite right, and it's not moving in the right direction. And yeah, I'm just trying to encourage people. I'm trying to help people understand why it is, and then trying to encourage them to that there is another way, a fundamentally different way of thinking about, you know, being in the world.
You encourage us when you write, Christians must stand stubbornly, prophetically, and by reason of basic Christian convictions, squarely in the path of this fruitless exchange. We must insist that when the trajectory of modern technological development is away from ordinary embodied existence, is it at odds with God's purposes for his world. Although it may seem as if we have been left to our own devices to solve our own problems, we have not. God is there, and he is for us. He will surely accomplish everything that he has promised. In the meantime, we must encourage each other to be both patient and hopeful. Gets back to a comment you made earlier in the program. You certainly have hope, don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, hope's a commandment.
Yes.
I mean, that's what we have to offer. And that's what the gospel of Jesus Christ gives. So, yeah.
But that hope has to also, you indicate, whatever hope we have for reforming modern technology must also be tempered by patience and restraint. Patience in the sense that we must not collapse the not yet of the coming kingdom of God into the already of present possibilities. Restraint in the sense that we must continue to acknowledge and respect the distinctive shape of created nature. How do we do that? How do we respect the distinctive shape of created nature?
At the very least, rather than seeing it as a kind of limitation that we must somehow overcome with our technology, we instead learn and patiently and to live within it. Part of this is learning to live within time rather than always trying to overcome time, trying to compress it, trying to, fit more into it all the time that we do.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of, I think, things that we could think of, which, it just requires us to think about, why is it that the world is the kind of place that it is, and what did God have in mind? What was his desire for us? And admittedly, things aren't the way they ought to be, and we are waiting for the coming kingdom. But still, creation is good, and created order is good. It's the place this is the place that God has given us to be and to become ourselves. And it just seems like the modern mindset is that our job is to overcome every natural limit and every barrier. And I think that may be true to some extent, but I think at the same time, it might be a good idea to reflect upon just how it is that we live most fully within the limits that we, within the constraints that we find ourselves placed in.
And the most basic reality that confronts us in nature, you're quoting someone else, is that it is God's world, not ours. That's a primary understanding. Wow.
Well, that is basic, right? And it's like that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who's read the Bible. And yet, we don't often live that way, right? We live as if the world is ours, and it's full of stuff that it's up to us to just impose our values upon and to use as we see fit. And that's a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
We need to repent of that. That's something that we've got to back away from.
You write, the world is decidedly not a chance aggregate of matter propelled by a blind force, and it is not therefore indifferent to human interests. On the contrary, created nature is precisely where we belong. It has been painstakingly and deliberately crafted by an all-powerful and, most importantly, beneficent and loving creator to provide just the kind of place where we can, as embodied human beings, flourish and thrive. So yeah. It goes back to basics in many ways. And there's so much more that I could quote, but even in just this particular final chapter. But as I said, I'd really like to talk a little bit in the closing, just about 5 minutes we have before the program ends, about the epilogue, about on Eucharistic embodiment. And you have Basil of Caesarea, what is Christianity? Likeness to God as far as is possible for human nature. Tell us a little bit about why you wrote this last epilogue, and what you believe we need to learn from it.
Well, I mean, the theme throughout the book is on the rediscovery of the importance of embodiment and embodied human being, and it sort of obviously raised the question of, well, you know, from a Christian point of view, what can we say about that? And I don't know, at some point, I can't remember, but I was talking to somebody and they said, oh, well, that's, you should talk about the Eucharist. And it was like, well, of course, that's absolutely right. So then the question was, okay, where do I put that, and how do I organize it? I decided to put it in as the sort of culmination of the argument, because it just needed to be said.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of, I rely on the theology of Eucharist developed primarily by John Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really quite wonderful, and I think which most people, even within, you know, traditions that have ties to Calvinism, have forgotten. But it's this notion that our bodies are given life through the body and blood of Christ. And that in the Eucharist, we make actual contact with the real presence, the real body of Christ, and that's, you know, this is made possible by the Holy Spirit and in the Church, but it's full of hope. We're looking forward to this future in which we will finally become most fully ourselves as embodied persons. But it's just the kind of thing that I think it's a ritual that we do week by week, and it provides us with a way, I think, of thinking about ourselves and about our world.
Yes.
Hopefully it spoke to you.
It did, without a doubt. And it's the shortest. The epilogue, of course, is the shortest part of the book, and yet, in some sense, to me, it becomes the most important, because you write, our union with Christ in the Eucharist signals that we are ourselves enduringly transformed in our ingestion of the consecrated bread and wine. just as the incarnation signals that God has determined to indwell created reality in such a way as to render it even more real than it was before, it is precisely into this quote-unquote more that we are graciously introduced into the celebration of the Eucharistic feast. I could go further. We've unfortunately run out of time, but Professor Gay, thank you so very much for being here. Again, the title of the book is Modern Technology and the Human Future.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
I would like sometime, if I weren't so old, I'd like to come and sit in your class sometime.
Well, I'd love to have you.
All right. Thank you.
I look forward to that.
Bless you and your family.
You too.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
We've come towards the end of the program. We've skipped around in the book, but there is so much more. Let me just read again from the book as a kind of a closing for the program. From a Christian point of view, contemporary technology's divergence away from the requirements of ordinary embodied human life indicates a serious problem. Anything that undermines, enfeebles, or otherwise diminishes ordinary embodied human existence must be seen to be at odds with the divine purposes signaled in the incarnation and resurrection of Jesus Christ. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer once commented, quote, God did not become an idea, principle, a program, a universally valid belief, or a law, or we might add a system. God became human. This means Christ does not abolish human reality in favor of an idea that demands to be realized against all that is real. Christ empowers reality, affirming it as the real human being and thus the ground of all human reality. Close quote. This Christian empowering of reality, this absolute affirmation of ordinary embodied human being, is very, very good news for a whole variety of reasons, not least of which is that it provides the vantage point from which to evaluate and give discipline to modern technological development. And so we must try now to remember the basic shape of Christian theology, recollecting all of the ways that this theology affirms ordinary reality and ordinary embodied human life within what was and remains God's good creation. We must follow up on our recollection with practicing resurrection together, trying humbly, hopefully, to live out the implications of our theology. It looks like we still have time. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcasts.